All right. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Wisconsin Supreme Court is now in session. The Honorable Chief Justice Jill J. Karofsky presiding. Your silence is commanded.
You all can sit down, thanks. Give me just 1 second. Less than a month. Good morning, everybody. Thank you for your patience. Our first case today is State versus JDB. Let's start with appearances, please. Good morning, everybody. Ms. Jensen, I have you for 25 minutes, Mr. Swank 30, and then rebuttal for 5. Whenever you're ready.
Good morning. Thank you, Chief Justice, and may it please the court. This moot case involves involuntary medication to restore trial competency, presents this court with its first opportunity to interpret and apply the cell factors. Certainly, there's a lot to cover in this case, and there's a lot going on with these factors, and I'm going to try to divide my time today in a way that tracks my brief, starting with the first cell factor, important governmental interests, and then I'll get into the remaining three factors, and I think it makes the most sense to address the standard of review when we get to those factors. But broadly speaking, from the state's perspective, we really need this court's guidance on the following. On the first cell factor, how do we decide whether the government is prosecuting a serious crime, and what special circumstances might serve to undermine the government's interest? And on the remaining three factors, what is the standard of review? How are the Court of Appeals supposed to be reviewing these hearings and these orders? And then how specific does an individualized treatment plan need to be to satisfy due process? And I'm going to place a particular emphasis on that last point, because from the state's perspective, and you hear this from the experts in the amicus briefs as well, we feel that we're facing a bit of a moving target in terms of what needs to be in these treatment plans. So I'll start with the first cell factor. The government needs an important interest in seeking out an involuntary medication order. And Cell tells us that prosecuting a serious crime is important for these purposes. Cell doesn't give us a whole lot of guidance on what it means by serious crime.
Go ahead.
There doesn't appear to be a dispute about that. So I'm trying to figure out why we need to get to that. I mean, I understand sort of the desire for, please clarify things for us, but we like to decide the cases and issues that are presented, and adverse and necessary for deciding it, generally speaking. So why do we need to get into that?
Well, first I would say, I would remind this court that this case is moot, and Jared did convince the court to look at the mootness doctrine because there are significant issues at play here. And so I find it unpersuasive to now say on this issue about seriousness of the offense that has divided courts around the country, that this court's guidance isn't necessary. And I also don't agree that this court's decision on the method for deciding seriousness wouldn't affect the outcome of this case. I think if this court agrees with the state that you can factor in secondary considerations like the nature of the crime and deciding whether something's serious, I think that can affect the calculus when we're balancing it against potentially special circumstances that might undermine the government's interests.
Yeah, tell us a little bit more about what you're thinking about seriousness. I note that I think both parties agreed that the crime here in question is serious. From what I could determine, the bail statute itself indicates that this is in fact a serious crime, but can you elaborate on that?
Why I think the crime in this case, sure. And let me just walk through, if this court does adopt the model that we are proposing for serious crime, why I would think this crime is serious. We suggest that you first start by looking at the maximum statutory penalty. So here we have a class H felony. It carries 6 years imprisonment. I think a helpful comparison is to look and see how the U.S. Supreme Court has defined serious crime in another context. And that has to do with deciding whether someone gets a right to a jury trial. And they say anything carrying imprisonment for over 6 months is serious. I'm not asking for that bright line rule in this case. However, I think it's a helpful comparison. So we have a crime carrying 6 years imprisonment. I also think if you turn to secondary considerations, looking at the nature of the crime, it was violent. He assaulted a police officer. He threatened to kill family members. So we think those factors in combination would establish seriousness on this
Counsel,
record.
When we're looking at the circumstances of the crime, would it be appropriate to consider here that the crime in this case happened during the police response to what was apparently a mental health emergency? And unlike in most cases, the crime was actually committed right there before the officers. It wasn't that they were being, you know, reporting to a crime that had already been committed, but were, to me, that changes the nature of the crime quite a bit, that context. Do you think that's a special circumstance in cases like?
So if I'm understanding you correctly, or your question correctly, you're saying, does the fact that he was apparently suffering a mental health crisis in the moment of committing the crime matter?
Right. So in other words, I'm asking, is when we're looking at special circumstances, are we looking at factors like how the particular crime was committed in this case? Or do we just look at the level of the charge and then look at special circumstances that are kind of external to the crime itself? That's what I'm puzzled about.
Okay. I think the special circumstances have to be things that undermine the government's interest in prosecution.
Yeah.
And Sell doesn't identify the fact that a defendant committed the crime because they're suffering from a mental health crisis as a special circumstance that would undermine the government's interest.
But it gave a non-exclusive list.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah. And what I will say is, from the prosecution's perspective, we have numerous reasons why we prosecute crime, including protecting the public and seeking justice for crime victims. And from our perspective, those interests don't change if the person is suffering from a mental health crisis.
If the legislature wanted to define a serious crime, couldn't they do so by injecting those penalties or whatever considerations there?
Yeah. Yes. Yes. If the legislature were to speak on this and wants to characterize what crimes are sufficiently serious for cell purposes, we would be following that.
What about like a domestic abuse that's charged as a disorderly conduct? That's not serious?
I would not agree with that necessarily. I think, and that's why I'm not asking for a bright line rule. You know, I thought about, do we draw a felony misdemeanor distinction? But I'm not going to stand here today and say that no misdemeanor could ever be sufficiently serious for cell purposes. We've got, you know, class A misdemeanor, fourth degree sexual assault is a class A misdemeanor. I think depending on the facts of the case, we could see that as very serious.
So what's the rule you want?
So the rule I want is for this court to first say that the primary factor in deciding whether something is serious is to look at the maximum statutory penalty. We believe that courts should have the discretion to aggregate offenses. If there are multiple offenses, the court should have discretion in calculating what the maximum penalty is to look at multiple crimes. And then we believe secondary considerations like the nature or effect of the crime, the defendant's criminal history, can factor into that equation as well. I'm not asking for this court to draw a line in the sand in terms of what penalty would be sufficiently serious. I think it's a really hard line to draw. And in my review of the cases, I haven't seen a court land on a number. I want to talk a little bit about special circumstances. And again, as I was mentioning to Justice Crawford, the special circumstances discussed in Sell, I think it's important to really take a close look at that discussion, because the way I read those, they give two examples of special circumstances that might be sufficient to undermine the government's interest. The first is the potential that someone could serve lengthy confinement in civil commitment. And the second is, has this person sat for a significant amount of time pretrial credit-wise? And I view both of those circumstances and that discussion as really getting at risk mitigation. And let me explain what I mean. If no medication order is issued in a particular case, That very likely means that this prosecution is not going to go forward because the person is not going to be. Because at the point of a cell hearing, we do have a treating psychiatrist coming in and saying that this medication is necessary to restore this person to trial competency. So I think it's important to keep that in mind. And what Cell is saying is, are there situations that might reduce the risks that might otherwise be associated with releasing somebody without punishment for a serious crime? And I think the civil commitment example is a good example of that. That could provide a measure of public protection while a prosecution sits dormant because we weren't able to restore this person a competency. I view the discussion on whether someone has sat for a significant period of time as somewhat similar, right? If the person has sat in pretrial confinement for a significant period of time, we might see this as a deterrent effect, that we could feel comfortable releasing this person into the public without actually seeing through the prosecution. So if you view the special circumstances discussion in that light as about risk mitigation, I think it is clear that the Court of Appeals here erred in some of its special circumstances discussion. And I find three special circumstances that the Court of Appeals considered in this case to be irrelevant. And let me briefly touch on them. The first was the potential for an NGI commitment. As we discussed in our brief, that the potential for an NGI commitment can't possibly provide a measure of public protection if the prosecution doesn't go forward, because we have to prosecute the person to get an NGI commitment. So we feel that that circumstance was irrelevant for the Court of Appeals to consider. The second discussion had to do with bail. The Court of Appeals raised sua sponte the question of whether Jared was wrongfully denied bail. And setting aside, and we don't agree that he was wrongfully denied bail, but setting that aside, we still feel that the wrongful denial of bail is irrelevant to the cell analysis because it is already accounted for by factoring in how much pretrial confinement there was. And I don't see a connection other than that connection to pretrial confinement. Why would we be asking about the wrongful denial of bail? And I want to reiterate, the special circumstances that Cell is talking about, they're not just any perceived wrongs that we see that might have happened up to the point of a cell hearing. It has to be things that undermine the government's interest in prosecuting a serious crime. The third special circumstance that I'd like this court to hold was irrelevant has to do with this delay in transfer for treatment from the jail to the inpatient treatment facility. We feel that this discussion was irrelevant. I think it was imprudent based on the record that we had, and I think it was legally incorrect. In terms of being irrelevant, again, I think the Court of Appeals didn't explain why that would be a relevant factor that would undermine the government's interest in prosecuting a serious crime. My guess was the suggestion is that if we're not transferring someone to an inpatient facility quickly enough, that says something about how serious we view this prosecution.
Well, and in fact, counsel, doesn't it suggest that the state didn't prioritize that particular defendant to get him into the treatment facility sooner than other people who needed similar treatment? Wasn't the Court of Appeals just assessing it as where the state prioritized this case among others in treating this individual for competency restoration?
Well, I'll start by saying I think there is this presumption, because we don't have a record on why he wasn't transferred. I think the presumption is it was a space issue. And so if it was a space issue, I don't agree that saying that some people have to wait in line while others receive adequate inpatient care in facilities speaks to whether we view a particular prosecution as important.
And if there had been evidence on this record, and maybe there isn't, but if there had been evidence that the state does in fact prioritize higher level crimes for treatment for competency over lower levels, would that support the Court of Appeals analysis here that that is a circumstance?
Possibly, if there were that evidence. Okay. There weren't.
And there's just not here.
Yeah, okay. Correct. Yes.
What job is it to raise special circumstances? Does the defense need to do it, or does the judge need to be asking in every single one of these hearings, is there a special circumstance?
It's the state's position that this court should join the other five federal circuits that have all said it's the defendant's obligation to raise special circumstances. They are both best positioned and best incentivized to be the ones to raise these special circumstances to the court. And I know there is language in CEL saying, you know, courts have to consider the facts of the individual case, but I think those five federal circuits have rightly read that language to say courts have to consider any special circumstances that are brought to their attention. So we are asking this court to hold that defendants can forfeit special circumstances by not raising them. And I think we should be encouraging, I think, you know, yes, you could say that the circuit court has this obligation, but I don't know where we would draw the line on that. And I think it also benefits the defendant to have advocacy in terms of special circumstances. So,
counsel, I want to clarify what, get you to clarify what you mean by the, in your briefs, you characterize this as a burden on the defendant. And, you know, these are not situations typically that are involving an extended evidentiary hearing, right? So, and burden generally is referring to a burden of proof or a burden of production of evidence. It seems to me that what you're saying is that the defense has to, in argument, identify what it wants the trial court to consider as special circumstances. Otherwise, it will be deemed to have waived or forfeited on appeal if the issue doesn't come out their way.
That's correct. I think it's maybe I used some inartful language there.
Yeah. So yeah. You're just saying that the defense needs to articulate what it believes might be special circumstances, not to say that they have some necessarily a burden of presenting evidence or proof.
Correct. And so then it would be if they aren't presented at the circuit court, they are forfeited on appeal. And we do think it's inappropriate for the court of appeals to sua sponte or raise special circumstances or reverse the circuit court. We gave the example of kind of classic blindsiding.
And one of the reasons I wanted to clarify that, counsel, is that this is a circumstance in which the defense attorney is unable to confer with their client. That person is incompetent and unable to assist in their defense by definition. So anything that imposes a burden on the defendant seems to me to overstate substantially what the defendant's obligations should be in that circumstance. So why not say that the trial court does have a duty in applying the CEL factors to independently consider whether special circumstances are present, understanding that, you know, once we get to the appellate court, if the defense is relying on circumstances that weren't argued, that they may be subject to a waiver.
Well, I don't think some of these things will be readily apparent to the circuit court. I would give you that pretrial confinement could be something that the circuit court could easily figure out on its own. But, you know, some of the issues in terms of the defendant's mental health history, that might be incompetency reports. I do think it's fair to say that the defense attorney, I don't think they have to confer or get help from their clients to review these competency reports, identify any kind of mental health history. They can consult with the Chapter 51 commitment standard and make arguments on behalf of their client.
Does the trial court err if the defense does not offer any special circumstances and the record is just silent on whether the trial court considered any presence or absence of
circumstances? No
error in that correct situation. Okay.
I do want to circle back to the delay and transfer issue. I know I covered a little bit, but it is an aspect of the opinion that the state finds concerning. Getting into the merits of, you know, we talked about why we believe it was imprudent because we didn't have a record. And really at the end of the day, whether there was a due process violation has to do with reasonableness. And so of course, that's a very fact intensive inquiry. Legally though, on the merits, I do want to comment. I believe the Court of Appeals reading of Jackson is incorrect. And so to the extent that this court reaches the merits of that legal issue, I think it's important to really take a look at the Jackson opinion. That was a case where Indiana had a statute that allowed for indefinite commitment to restore somebody to competency. And the experts in that case opined that Jackson was unlikely to regain competency to stand trial. And Indiana still committed this individual for over 3.5 years. So I really think it's important to consider the language in Jackson about commitment. Commitments can only last for a reasonable amount of time. Commitments have to be justified by progress towards the goal of competency restoration. It's really important to read that language in context. Here, In response to Jackson, our legislature has put a limit on competency commitments of 1 year or less if the max penalty is less. We also have built in 3 month periodic review periods where we have an expert come in, see how the defendant is doing. If the defendant is not competent and not likely to regain, they have to be released. If they are not competent, but they still believe within that period, that statutory period, that they can be restored to competency, we go forward. But my point is just, we already have, the legislature has already given due process protection to defendants. And so the Court of Appeals opinion here that a 3.5 month delay in transfer from the jail to the inpatient treatment facility, when Jared was receiving some competency restoration services at the jail, he was being offered antipsychotic medication. To say that that was a due process violation, we think is an absolutely incorrect reading of Jackson.
Do you think we should even be addressing whether it's a due process violation or whether the defendant has this statutory right to pretrial release or a bail hearing when those were issues that the Court of Appeals raised on their own and were not part and parcel of this record?
I think I would be happy for this court to say that these were irrelevant to sell, or that, you know, thinking about the party presentation rule, that these weren't things that the Court of Appeals should have raised on its own.
I am most concerned, if you wouldn't mind addressing, and I know you're going to get there, with the issue of whether this was an individualized treatment plan or not.
Please.
And I would like you to please address why you think this treatment plan couldn't just be used for any defendant who is suffering from these schizophrenia. Like, what makes it individualized to JDB, given there was an indication on the form that JDB has no other medical conditions, when we know that JDB does in fact have medical conditions? And so that piece, and also just this list of medication, when the doctor said, that's not even an order to go in. That's just could it be used for anybody? What makes it individual?
And I'm just going to continue with her question, because I think we both have some of those, same concerns. And I know that your yellow light is on. The doctor's treatment plan clearly concerns all of us, or some of us here. But I would say that the doctor indicated that Jared previously had a partial response to 4 medications. Beyond that, it didn't mention any of the other requirements as per Green, and he didn't testify on those matters. So if you could just combine both of our questions into your answer, we'd appreciate it.
Sure. So these last 3 cell factors, what I view the government's obligation is to convince the circuit court that the medication is effective, it's going to restore trial competency, that it's safe for this defendant, and that it is necessary. It is a last resort. In this case, we have a doctor with 13 years experience who came in and said that he met with this patient 5 times. He testified that he did review his patient's medical records. He testified that he observed his patient's responses to antipsychotic medication taken in conjunction with other medications. Specifically, the medication that he did want to start him on, the doctor had observed Jared's responses to it, and there were no adverse side effects whatsoever. So we have a doctor here that said all of that, and none of that evidence was refuted at the cell hearing. So this aspect of the Court of Appeals opinion that says, well, this doctor did not know his patient because he says there are no notable physical health conditions, but I'm looking at, you know, the Court of Appeals went outside the record and looked at competency reports that weren't utilized at the hearing. So the circuit court had no reason to doubt the doctor's testimony in this case. And I want to push back on what I really view as a presumption of ineffectiveness that the Court of Appeals afforded to this doctor. I think there was this assumption that the doctor didn't know anything about his patient. And I'm not sure why that is an appropriate assumption to apply. We presume that lawyers are effective, and we presume that lawyers act reasonably. And I don't think that same presumption was afforded to this doctor. And I think if the doctor had been asked, you say on your report, there's no physical health conditions, what do you mean by that? The doctor could have very likely said, I am aware of these physical health conditions, but they don't change my opinion that this is a medically appropriate plan because I have been observing this patient. The medication I want to restart him on is something that he has not had any adverse side effects for.
Okay, when you say start him on, where do you see he says, that's part of the problem.
In the record, Palo, I might be
I'm pretty sure he says there's no order, and I'm looking at the treatment plan and it lists something totally different. It does haloperidol first. It lists it as fourth.
So, Your Honor, the doctor's testimony at a hearing can supplement the treatment plan. That is law.
Where did he say in the?
He does say that he wants to. His plan was to start the doctor on paliperidone, which was the medication that he was using and Jared was taking sporadically. That is in the record.
Counsel, do you think there even needs to be a specific written treatment plan in this case? Why would it not be sufficient to put the doctor on the stand and introduce oral testimony?
I don't see why. I mean, I guess it's giving some, the treatment plan would give some notice to the defendant before the hearing on what the medications are. But I do view this as a holistic assessment that is going to be a combination of the doctor's testimony and what's in the treatment.
Just to follow up on the standard of review, because I think that part of what you're arguing, you talked about a presumption that the doctor knows what he's doing, but in some sense, we're trusting the trial court to make a finding that this doctor is credible, that when he says he met with him, reviewed the records, he's believing that, and he's making a finding that it is, you know, safe, necessary, and effective. How we review this, whether we're doing it again, whether we're doing sort of de novo, looking at, you know, what about this portion? What about this portion? Does that meet the standard versus deferring to the trial court's finding on that? That seems to be actually an incredibly critical part of this. You know, feel free to address that. But
no, I agree. And like I said, safe, effective, and necessary, which is what I think the three last factors are getting at, to me really strike me as factual questions. And I think that's why most federal circuits have reviewed those questions for clear error. And I agree that when viewed in that light, I think what the Court of Appeals did here was they should have been searching to see whether the circuit court's findings were against a great weight and clear preponderance of the evidence, and that didn't happen.
And in the Court of Appeals in, you know, Green, for example, as well, which seemed to require more detailed information, if we're allowing the trial court to make factual findings, then perhaps that level of detail also isn't necessary, as long as the trial court's finding that it was specifically individualized is credible based on the record.
Correct. And again, I would say the circuit court's, I'm sorry, my light is on, Chief Justice.
Please finish.
The circuit court's findings here were based on testimony that was unrefuted by a doctor addressing all the factors. Thank you.
Mr. Swink?
Thank you, and may it please the court. I want to start today by discussing kind of where the state left off, which is what is required in the actual treatment plan. I think Jared is asking the court to require the state, through its doctors, what anyone in this room would expect to get from their doctor when being prescribed medication, which is, what is the medication that is being prescribed? Why is that medication being prescribed? Any potential side effects of that medication? And then how that medication is administered, talking about how much medication to take and how frequently.
What was the last point? Side effects, and then what was the...
How the medication would be administered and monitored. So, especially with Judge Crawford's last question to the state regarding, does a treatment plan even need to exist? I think DHS and their amicus brief seem to call for overturning Green, essentially, trust our doctors, that should be good enough.
Well, counsel, I think my question was more directed at the form of evidence that needs to be introduced, and why isn't it sufficient to have a doctor's oral testimony responding to questions as opposed to a separate written plan laying out what the medications are? That seems overly formalistic to me.
Sure, and I think I'm not saying that a treatment plan is necessary, but the point I'm getting to is the state needs to explain and give the circuit court sufficient information And how it does that, I'm not super concerned with, but it needs to do that. And the treatment plan here did not do that by just listing a bunch of medications and then the doctor essentially getting up to say, this is appropriate. If there is no treatment plan, then I think there is a notice issue to the defense of you as an attorney are walking in, not a psychiatrist, and having to essentially hear what a doctor thinks is appropriate.
But counsel, you know, we really, I think, shared our concerns with the state about that. And she responded, there were 5 meetings. He reviewed the medical records, observed the responses, talked about no adverse side effects. Doesn't that all get factored in?
I think it can, yes. I think doctor's testimony does get factored into whether or not a plan is appropriate and whether or not the circuit court has been provided sufficient information. I think the things we're missing here is how are these medications going to be used? The doctor did say that he would start with paliperidone, which is the medication Jared had been taking voluntarily. Whether or not that was effective when he was taking it is kind of up for debate based on the record. But the doctor didn't explain any of the other medications that were listed, any of the oral medications, any of the injectable medications. What the treatment plan said was that those medications would be used in combination or succession. There was no limit on how the doctor would administer those medications. There was no explanation as to why that sort of...
Well, is it a given that it's a trial and error situation or not?
I don't think it is a given because of the use, especially of the word in combination, because ostensibly that plan allowed the doctor to use all of those medications at once up to the maximum dosage, which, again, I'm not a psychiatrist. I can pretty safely assume that that would not be appropriate, but it would be allowable under this treatment plan.
But counsel, then you're assuming that the doctor might do something inappropriate, but the doctor, of course, is subject to his own ethical obligations, the Hippocratic Oath, and... It sounds as if you may be presuming that the doctor, because he could do something harmful to the patient, that he do something harmful to the patient.
I agree with that to the extent that I think those other systems exist, essentially a patient who isn't treated appropriately could sue the doctor. The doctor could be committing malpractice that could be dealt with. Subsequently, I think CEL provides sort of a prophylactic measure to prevent doctors from acting inappropriately. And it does that by having them explain to the court why what they're doing is going to be appropriate.
Does the court even have the competency to challenge what the doctor is presenting?
I think, so the best way I can frame that is I don't think the court needs to be an expert and push back on the doctor. I think someone, when I was mooting this, gave me this sort of template, and I don't think it exactly covers it, but I think it's a good way to think about it. The court needs to be in a position where it basically could give informed consent on the patient's behalf. Essentially, the doctor needs to provide sufficient information to explain what this treatment plan is, how it will be administered, and why it's appropriate. I think if we look to the amicus brief, they talk about how doctors need this sort of flexibility because treatment can be varied. They might need to change medications on a moment's notice, and that's why there might be this unordered list of a bunch of medications. I think that's fine and that's appropriate if that was explained to the circuit court, which it wasn't. And so I think that's the core of why this treatment plan in this case isn't appropriate. I think that's the guidance this court should give to lower courts as far as...
Oh, please finish.
As far as what they're looking for when they're evaluating whether or not a plan is sufficient.
Wait, what's
so? Is it?
Can I just ask a clarifying question before you get to yours?
Mine is a clarification
okay,
question,
go ahead.
If you don't mind.
Of course.
Thank you. Is it more of a notice issue to the court than you're suggesting that the court is sort of standing in the shoes of the patient? But it's also an important notice issue for the patient himself or herself because. We presume competency, right, during these hearings. And it may be that while the patient is listening or his attorney is listening, they know, okay, there's this drug that the doctor's mentioning. I tried that. I did have a bad adverse reaction. I mean, if I'm sitting in the shoes of the patient or the patient's attorney, I would rather have the full list so that I could weigh in at that point in time. So it sounds like you're saying it's important for the court to have all this information, but it's important for the committee or potential committee to have that as well.
I agree with that. And I actually think that it's a part of this case that I don't think is going to get a lot of attention. But when it comes to the competency to refuse aspect, I think that is included within that, in that Melanie L. and the statute say the doctors have to describe the specific medications to the patient. And so assuming what Dr. Illichman did in this case was appropriate, presumably he would have had to have talked with Jared about all of the medications that he was requesting. And so I think that is important for the patient as well. And I think that's required separately under the statute for a different reason.
One last follow-up. You aren't suggesting that if in the treatment plan there is a medication that is omitted, that the doctor or the state would have to go back to court to get permission to use a different drug. You're not arguing that, are you?
I think they would have to, because CEL specifically talks about the particular medications at issue. And so I think that's why a lot of the federal courts have kind of grafted onto this treatment plan being a requirement, is that the doctors need to be limited in some way, and that is through the particular medications they're going to use. And so it may make sense for a doctor to list the 9 antipsychotics here and say, I might use these depending on what happens. It's the explaining that second part, the depending on what happens, to the circuit court in at least some extent, to some extent.
So you think CEL requires this micromanagement from the courts, which arguably don't have the competency to say this drug, but not that one?
I don't think it needs the micromanagement. Again, I think the state bears the burden to prove by clear and convincing evidence that what they are proposing is appropriate. I don't think that courts need to say, well, I don't like this medication, or I don't think this is appropriate. I think the doctor needs to explain why it is.
So, counsel, I want to drag you back to those first factors. And I would say, if you want to talk a little bit more about micromanagement, go ahead, because I do think it tends to sound a lot like micromanagement to me. I asked the state the same question in regarding whether or not Jared's crime qualifies as serious under the first CEL factor. Anything you want to add to that?
So I appreciate Justice Hagedorn's first question, because I don't think seriousness of the crime is an issue in this case. I understand the state seems upset based on the Court of Appeals using the bail statute as essentially guidance. I don't think the Court of Appeals was saying that's the only definition of what is serious. We were not arguing that this crime was serious. I've joked about this, that I would not get in front of a bunch of judges and say that battery to law enforcement is not a serious crime. I have concerns with the state wanting to rely on the maximum penalty, because there, I think, is a very fair argument that if you go based on that and you go based on the federal case law, that you're going to wind up in a position where battery to law enforcement may not be considered serious. I was looking at Berry, which is a Sixth Circuit case, and they say that only one circuit has held that a crime with a maximum penalty of 5 years, which in federal court is 5 years in, we're talking about 3 years in on an H felony, only one court has found that to be serious, and the court in Berry did not want to create a hard and fast rule. So I think it makes more sense to rely on what the legislature has already deemed serious than trying to create a mishmash of different judges in different counties debating what is the right length of time. I don't think this court necessarily wants to put a hard and fast rule on the amount of time either. And so that's why I think I proposed relying on crimes the legislature has deemed serious, because it's objective, it shows what the legislature believes is serious, and it doesn't result in this sort of subjective considerations the state.
If the legislature's deemed those serious in other contexts, wouldn't it be better to leave it to the discretion of the trial court judge, because the trial court judge then has all of the facts surrounding the history of this particular person, taking into account the mental illness, taking into account a lot of other things that I think the state is saying that the court should take into account, which then leaves lots of leeway for argument on both sides.
Yeah, and I guess, obviously, I argue it in a brief. I think a fundamental what I disagree with on the state is that those other considerations should come into what I'm considering the first step of determining whether or not the crime is serious. I understand the appeal of considering things like criminal history and the specific facts alleged in the complaint and things like that. But I go back to the federal courts, which all seem to agree, at least upon my reading, that this is supposed to be an objective test. And once you start considering criminal history, specific allegations, things like that, then we are just subjectively determining whether or not this person committed a serious crime based on what the state has already alleged this presumed innocent person did. And if you do that, the same crime is not going to be serious across the state. You're going to have people in one county who are being medicated based on a supposedly serious crime when very similar facts could be not serious to another judge in another county. And I don't think the Constitution can permit that sort of disparity when we're talking about administering these medications. And so I think the court should adopt essentially the most objective standards that we have available to us. If it is going to be based on the maximum penalty, I think the court shouldn't go any further than the maximum penalty.
To be clear, your position at first, we're not contesting that it's a serious crime. So I guess I'm still having trouble figuring out why we're arguing about this. It's like two sides. No, I agree. The answer is X. No, I agree. The answer is X. Let's determine how we figure out whether the answer is X. You both agree it was a serious crime. I'm trying to figure out what else we need. Why? And I get the Court of Appeals went into it. And I get the Court of Appeals developed, you know, an elaborate set of, you know, procedures for analyzing the question. But we're going to take this case. We're going to answer the question, you know, God willing, one way or the other. But I don't know why we need to. I don't even know why we need to get into that in this fact scenario.
I agree, and I wouldn't have liked to devote half my brief to it, but I don't think the court needs to answer that question in this case because it is uncontested. I think the court could wait for another case on another day if it continues to be an issue, and so I would be happy if the court did not answer the question.
Let's talk about special circumstances then.
Can you say that again?
Let's talk about special circumstances then.
Sure.
How many are there? How is a court supposed to know which one's relevant in a particular case? How's the state supposed to know what's relevant in a particular case? Why shouldn't a defendant have to raise those, since it would seem to me out of all the people in the courtroom, the defense would have the most information when it comes to special circumstances?
Sure. And so I think Your Honor said it originally, is that this is, Sell gave courts essentially a non-exhaustive list of special circumstances to consider. And so things I think should be considered obviously come from Cell, is the possibility of a commitment or confinement resulting from a commitment, the possibility or the amount of credit someone has. I think an NGI commitment should be considered because of what the state's interests actually are.
How are they going to know if this is as early as this case was, but right? It's at the initial appearance. No one, an NGI is not like competency. NGI is a strategic decision made by a defendant. So now you're asking people at an initial appearance, you're asking a judge to look at a criminal complaint, which is about the only information you would have at an IA, and to determine whether or not someone is going to eventually plead NGI. And then you're not done. Then you have to look into your crystal ball and figure out what the result of that is going to be. Some of the other ones I can wrap my head around. That one just seems really bonkers to me.
So I understand the court's concern. I guess I will correct your question to a certain extent, is that we're not talking about the initial appearance. We're talking about when medication is being ordered, whether or not an NGI is likely or appropriate. And I think the consideration at that stage makes a little bit more sense on the possibility, because we have someone here who at the time medication was ordered had 245 days of credit.
You don't know if they're going to plead NGI, and you're right. Thank you for the clarification, right? I was thinking about the initial hearing we had, because we had all the discussion about the bail, which I don't want to talk about right now. Yes, it's at a later hearing. But even so, they have a bunch of credit. I mean, that doesn't, If I look at a case and I see someone has a lot of credit, that doesn't go ding, 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 this person is now going to plead NGI.
I think it does. And the reason I think that is because you have someone, Jared in this case was facing a 3-3 sentence on an H felony with nearly an 11-month sentence worth of credit. If the state wasn't going to agree to something like time served, I think that very much increases the chances that someone in that scenario would plead NGI. I think that is something the court can consider, and I think that is calculus that the court could have made at that time.
Okay, when you
sounds
say
like that's a lot of speculation. My bigger concern is whose job is it to bring this up at the hearing?
Sure, and I think Sell very clearly puts that burden on the circuit court. I think this court also has said to a certain degree that that is on the circuit court. I want to quote from Fitzgerald very briefly in paragraph 29. Cell requires the circuit court, emphasized, to conclude that the administration of medication is medically appropriate, not merely that the medical personnel administering the drugs observe appropriate medical standards. Obviously, that's talking about a different factor, but it recognizes Cell putting that burden on the circuit court. I want to focus on the indication that defense counsel is in a better position to raise some of these issues. The things that the state mentioned as far as things the court can rely on, competency reports, the amount of credit, the allegations in the criminal complaint, that is all available to the circuit court as well. It is not that defense counsel is in a better position to read those things or to raise those things. The other issue I think Justice Crawford brought up is that we are talking about an incompetent defendant. There are incompetent defendants who are delusional and refuse to want to participate in the proceedings writ large. If that person tells their attorney, I don't want you to participate because I don't want you to argue, the attorney is bound by the client's direction there, and they may not be able to argue these sorts of things. While that might be an extreme scenario, it may not be what happened here, it is a real possibility. And I think that the Constitution requires the circuit court to at least give some oversight.
Well, counsel, isn't it also true, though, that if defense counsel does not argue to the court that some factor in the case is a special circumstance, that they could be held to have waived or forfeited that argument if the case is appealed? In other words, something that was known to the everybody, including the defense attorney at the time of the hearing, that defense attorney has an obligation to argue that if that's going to be relied on as a basis to overturn the trial court's determination. Isn't that true?
So I think that is a bit trickier than it seems on its surface. I think it would be easy to say you didn't argue it is forfeited. Obviously, there can be ineffective assistance counsel.
There's lots of doctrines to get around that.
You could do that. I guess in this case in particular, obviously, forfeiture was never argued. However, there are instances where I get concerned by that happening. I will give DEC, another published court of appeals case, as an example of that. There, the defense attorney came in and questioned the doctor about the medication plan using the labels from the FDA. The doctor's response was, I'm not aware of essentially what the FDA label says because I rely on this textbook. The DEC on appeal essentially got that textbook and included it in the appendix to the Court of Appeals. And the Court of Appeals said that that issue was forfeited because the doctor who showed up at that hearing and talked about this textbook that no one had ever heard of wasn't given a chance to be cross-examined on it. And so I think that comes back to the core point of this from my perspective, which is the state needs to be providing this information if this is what it's going to be asking for, especially if we're going to rely on this adversarial process of cross-examination to see if what the state is doing is appropriate.
How many special circumstances did you list in your brief or did you talk about?
Without having reviewed my brief, I don't know. I would say it was probably close to 4 or 5.
So I'm confused as to how you see this court hearing going in front of it. Is the judge supposed to say, am I supposed to ask the question from the trial court judge and say, are there special circumstances? Am I supposed to go through the 4 or 5 in your brief? I don't think the 4 or 5 that you had in your brief are exhaustive, right?
Yep.
So what if the circuit court judge says, I don't see 3, but there are 2 other ones that no one pointed out at the hearing?
So I understand the court's concern there as far as what guidance to give circuit courts, how they should be conducting these hearings. And I think we're in a difficult, I have a what I think is an answer, a law and practice answer, not a this court issuing a decision answer, unfortunately. And I guess I would refer the court to the treatment plan form that DHS is now using as a result of this decision, which essentially requires doctors or asks doctors to give some of this information to consider the medical conditions as it relates to the medications, things like that. And so when it comes to special circumstances, I think courts should be at the very least looking at the things that Cell talks about, which is the credit and the possibility of commitment. I think circuit courts are in a position to do that based on the allegations, especially in a case like Jared's, where competency is raised right away and it's pretty clear that what was happening was a mental health crisis. I think the court was in as good a position as anyone else to say he's dangerous based on punching a police officer. He's mentally ill because the doctor's saying he's mentally ill. He's treatable because the doctor is saying he can be restored to competency. So at the bare minimum, I think courts need to be considering the two factors that Sell outlined specifically. I think other considerations, as included in the briefing, may be worth the court pointing out, but I don't think necessarily that any specific factor needs to be required. It may not be appropriate for a case. It may be that an issue is forfeited if defense counsel should have raised it. It could be that a court, the circuit court, may not be wrong for not considering a factor that no one else had previously thought of.
Right, but you just pointed out all kinds of different ways. And Justice Krofsky's question was, how is this supposed to work? Who's got, I don't want to say burden. Well, it's not a burden, but who needs to raise it? And what you just answered was everybody. The circuit court needs to raise it if it's this. The defendant needs to raise it if it's this. How's anyone going to know what the heck they're supposed to do with these special circumstances? According to your, I'm like looking for, what do you want us to say? And I'm going to ask you another question to go back, way back to where you were before, along those same lines. But what would you want us to say about special circumstances here? What's the holding?
I think the court needs to say to circuit courts that you need to consider the possibility of a commitment. You need to consider the maximum credit. You need to consider the defendant's criminal history or lack thereof. It may not be aggravating necessarily, but it could be a neutral factor.
Okay, now you're too, I heard you say before it was objective, and now you want the court to consider the criminal history. Is that in the first part when we're talking about whether it's serious or not, or now you want us to do it, courts to do it in the second part with the special circumstances?
I think that mitigating or case-specific material only comes in the second part because that's what Sell says. It says that courts must consider the circumstances of the case as they may be mitigated.
Okay, and circumstances, what if the court has no idea that the defendant is going to raise self-defense, for example? How would the court possibly know that that's a defense? And if it possibly is the court supposed to consider that when considering whether the state should be able to pursue their prosecution? I mean, how this goes down and down and down, like, where does this end?
Sure, I don't think the court has to go that far. Like I said, things limited to the record. So the complaint, the prior competency reports, all of which the court will have reviewed at some point, I think is what the court should be relying on. Whether or not it's self-defense is likely to involve discussions with the client that may or may not have happened yet. I don't think that would be fair to raise on appeal to say, well, you didn't consider this thing that no one brought up. But when we're talking about things that would apply in criminal cases writ large, I think those sorts of things are available to the circuit court.
So NGI is not one of those, because that is not in the record of whether the defendant is going to plead NGI.
So I think, again, this goes back to the facts of this case where competency is raised right away. Jared was taken to a medical center as a result of what appears to be a mental health crisis. I think it's pretty safe for a court to look at this and say he might end up pleading NGI.
Okay, now we're not looking at the record. Now we're looking at what we think the defendant might do.
Well, so I agree. I understand the concern.
I mean, I just don't, where are these lines?
And I would say that is looking at the record. The complaint lays all of this out as far as what is alleged to have happened. If that is in fact what happened, then I very much could see a court saying, yes, this person might plead NGI.
That's quite a leap you're asking us to take.
Sure.
That's quite a leap. Don't
you
agree?
Can I take you back to way back to the treatment plan? I caught you saying, I'm looking at what you're asking us to hold, because I am uncomfortable with some of the fact, as I've laid out, that the doctor said that there was no medications that JDB was taking. And there was no discussion of how those medications might interfere or interact with his conditions. So if you're again asking for a holding, what exactly would we be saying about the treatment plan here? Would you have us, and this gets back to the standard of review, would you have us say that it was an erroneous exercise of discretion by the circuit court? And if we were to then say what the circuit court did wrong, what would you want us to say? You said something about what the plan is, how it's administered. What are the things the circuit court would specifically need to do that they didn't do here?
Sure. So I guess what I would say is a treatment plan needs specific medications, specific doses and frequency of administration of those medications. Some explanation as to why that is appropriate. Here, the doctor said that he, or testified that he got essentially those numbers from the FDA labels, which is, I guess, a start to saying, here's some other authority that says this is appropriate. And then a discussion of potential side effects, why those side effects may or may not impact this particular case, and a discussion of the person's medical record and whether or not that would impact the medications being offered. I think that is a very bare minimum, short, concise information that I would want if I was being asked to take medication.
And the things that we're missing here in your mind are the discussion of side effects as to this defendant, because they did talk about side effects.
I think it is the treatment plan saying that Jared has no medical conditions when in the record it was clear that he had medical conditions, which when you look at the labels for the medications being proposed are flagged as being concerning. And more specifically and more blatantly to me is that there's no frequency of administration of medications. And if there's no frequency, then doctors theoretically could administer medications however they wanted. And that's when I go back to CEL provides this prophylactic measure where judges aren't just giving doctors free rein. We could easily have done that. If the court had wanted to do that, CEL would not exist. It would not have created what the state has to prove in order for the state to just walk in with magic words that doctors need to say that this is medically appropriate and we will administer it appropriately.
I'm sorry, go ahead. I want you to finish.
I was going to address the standard review, but I'll...
You've said the court, you know, is in the position to give informed consent on the patient's behalf. So the things you were just listing seem to be what you said. If I were a patient, this is what I would want to know. So CEL is a substantive due process case, right? So that's the world we're living in legally, constitutionally. Can you explain for me why the court being in the position of the patient for informed consent purposes is the same thing as what substantive due process might require in ordering medication in this case? In other words, why are you correct in making that assertion?
Because I think that goes to the nature of the factors that CEL outlined when it comes to being likely to restore a defendant and being medically appropriate and saying that circuit courts have to make that determination. Essentially, the state needs to prove to circuit courts or convince them by clear and convincing evidence that the medications being offered are appropriate. And so I think that's kind of where it gets into the substantive due process consideration is what does the state need to show in order to overcome this person's right to refuse medication?
Well, and CEL seems to me to frame these factors much more broadly in terms of, is medication medically appropriate as a way to treat this patient? Is medication going to significantly further the state's interest in prosecution? Is it unlikely in this case to interfere with the defendant's ability to assist counsel, which, you know, goes to competency? And here we have a record showing that the doctors wanted to treat JDB with psychotropic medications, that there are a variety of medications that can be used to address his particular psychosis, that they have certain side effects, and that there's going to be a trial and error process in determining what the accurate dosage and particular most effective medication is going to be in his case. And I'm just struggling to see under CEL, under the broad due process standard articulated in CEL, how that doesn't meet constitutional muster.
In my light is off, may I answer the question?
Please do.
Sure. And again, I think CEL created four broad factors. I agree with you on that point. However, CEL also, again, puts a burden on the state, clear and convincing evidence, to prove those factors. And so goes back to a point I made earlier. I'm not saying that a treatment plan necessarily in the way that we're seeing it and it is often done is required. I don't know of another way that the state would meet its burden in these cases. And I think CEL talks about particular medications. So while the factors themselves may be broad, I think cell's existence and its reference to specific medications gets us to this point where you need a treatment plan that is, explains what is going to happen. Thank you.
Can I just have him, you were going to get to the standard of review, you said. I'd like to hear your answer on that.
Sure. And I very much view this as, I understand the debate of between legal questions, factual questions, or a mixed question of fact and law. And I think this court's guidance in the Chapter 51 context makes a lot of sense here, because while these might be factual questions, at the end of the day, circuit courts are applying a legal standard. And so that's why I think it is a mixed question of fact and law, in that the circuit court may have made certain findings in this case or in other cases, but whether or not those findings were sufficient to get to the legal standards set forth as far as likelihood to restore, seriousness of the offense, and things like that, I think those are legal questions. And so I think it is a mixed question based on this court's own precedent and how the test works out.
Can I ask just one more quick follow-up on that? Your position on that, I think almost every court that has looked at the matter has disagrees with the position you're proffering to us today. Is that accurate?
It is accurate. And I tried to lay that out in the brief explaining where I think the federal circuit courts or courts of appeals got that wrong, and how my reading of it is essentially one court said that and then a bunch of courts agreed with that, and there's no real analysis behind that. And so that's why I'm more convinced by this court's own precedent on how these case or how a similar type of case is reviewed. Thank you.
Thank you, Attorney Swain. Attorney Jansen.
Very quickly, I'm going to take one more shot at convincing this court to get into the method for deciding seriousness.
All right, but before you do that, does the treatment plan need to be in writing?
I'm sorry?
Does the treatment plan need to be in writing?
I don't know of any case law that says it does.
So if it's not in writing, how do the providers at Mendota know how to treat the person they're tasked to treating? Do they get a copy of the transcript? What happens?
I think that's a fair point. And maybe that is why it should be in writing. But I do think the case law is pretty clear that circuit courts can entrust that whatever the doctors are testifying to at the hearing is going to be implemented going forward. So that's why they've kind of seen it as being able to supplement the treatment plan.
All right, and off to seriousness now.
Okay, thank you.
Go ahead.
Wait, before you get to the serious, I want to know what you think we should do about Green, because I want to know what you think we should do about Green. And
yes.
I'm looking and thinking mostly about paragraph 38. I'm also thinking about the amicus from DHS. Paragraph 38 of Green says court must consider the individual treatment plan as applied to a particular defendant. Age, weight, duration of illness, past responses to psychotropic medication, cognitive abilities, other meds, medical record, whether a particular drug given at a particular dosage for a particular duration is substantially likely to render the defendant competent.
So thank you. So this is what an individualized treatment plan looks like to the state based on the case law. I think we're comfortable with Green's minimum requirements. We have to identify the medications. We have to identify the maximum dosages. We have to identify the duration of treatment before a check-in is necessary. Doctors have to demonstrate familiarity with the medications, explain how they work, explain what the side effects are, and doctors have to demonstrate familiarity with the patient. My concern with Green is that it should not be applied in a form over substance manner. And this case is a great example of that. Maximum dosages. Why do we ask the government to explain what the maximum dosages are? Because we're trying to assure the circuit court that the medication being prescribed is both safe and effective. Here, yes, the doctor did not put the word daily on his treatment plan. He just had a dose range, not a quantity per unit of time. But the doctor's testimony was, I based my ranges based on what was submitted to the FDA as safe and effective levels. So to me, that is more illuminating to a circuit court in terms of assuring a circuit court that the medication is going to be safe and effective than just saying the words 5 to 7 milligrams daily. I think most circuit court judges don't have the medical background to know what that means.
So just to really drill down on this, you're not asking us to necessarily overturn that part of Green. It sounds like you're asking us to
rein it in.
Yeah, or actually broaden it a little bit, not be as specific as it is. Clarify it.
Yes, and again, because I think the problem is we really feel like the standards keep changing on us, and we keep finding out a new thing that we didn't know we were supposed to do that we're supposed to do. We really want this to be rooted in the case law, and I think we're getting away from that. So if I can return to seriousness,
we'll see.
What I want to say is we have a published opinion from the Court of Appeals that really doesn't give us a lot of guidance on this issue that obviously has divided courts. And one of the leading reasons given by the Court of Appeals was they looked at the bail statute and saw that it was listed as serious. So without further guidance, I do think litigants are going to, could read that opinion as saying that is that might be something that can preclude a crime from being serious because it's not listed.
Well, counsel, are you saying it was error to consider that the legislature has designated this as a serious crime in some part of the statutes? And I'm saying that as a different finding than a broader holding that all of the crimes so designated meet the cell threshold. But isn't that something that a trial court can look at in assessing whether a particular offense is seriousness for this purpose?
I think the answer would be the same just by looking at the maximum statutory penalty.
And why is that a better thing to look at in the statutes than the bail statute?
Sure, because as we noted in our brief, if we're only looking at how crimes have been designated as serious in different in contexts, that could produce some really absurd results. We gave examples of crimes that carry up to 18 and a half years imprisonment that aren't listed in any of those statutes as serious. So we're concerned about that.
So that might not be the exclusive list of seriousness offenses, but why would it be wrong for the trial court to consider that?
I just think my concern is that if we're just going to go and look, is this statute listed? No, it's not. My concern is that a circuit court would say, well, then it must not be serious for cell purposes.
At a minimum, are you asking us to not tie the hands of the trial courts and say they must restrict their determination of seriousness to that which has been designated so by the legislature? Because I think you, just one of your lists, not in the bail statute, we've got sexual assault of a child, use of a computer to facilitate a child sex crime, soliciting a child for prostitution. I don't think there's a trial court in the state that would say those are not serious offenses. And yet if they feel their hands are tied by the bail statute, then they would be compelled to so say.
That's exactly right. And so I think that is why we were concerned with just leaving the Court of Appeals opinion as is, because I think it could be read in that way. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll be adjourned until for about 15 minutes to our next one.